Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to take a more personal look at the president, his cabinet, and the impact their policies are likely to have. We've gotten a glimpse, enough to allow us to make some judgments, but I'm going to be sharing some insights today that I explained nearly a year ago, and that was that it is not the president himself that is solely the problem. It is the fact that we have elected a person who is, well, if you saw Mad Max, the Dome film with Tina Turner, there was this large, you know, guy that would kill people in an arena, and then in one scene, Mel Gibson's character knocks off its helmet that it was wearing and sees this kind of retarded figure in there. And in some ways, we should try to understand the likely outcome of this president's decision-making process by how he is almost having to be judged as a person who has the intellectual capacity of maybe a 12-year-old, 13-year-old. And that's very dangerous. Now, what do I mean? What specifically am I referring to? I'll share that with you in the program. I have written several commentaries today, plus I have a commentary from Mike Snyder, from Economic Collapse, from Professor Henry Giroux, from Tycoon, and from Chris Hedges, from Truth Dig, Make America Ungovernable. I also have some new information today that I feel we must pay attention to. Yes, the environment's number one in my priorities because I see what's happening and how unprepared we are for what I consider some unsustainable living of humans, for most humans on Earth, if we do not begin to make some changes immediately. But also, we are in the midst of the most precarious financial situation in American history, dwarfing the previous crash of 2008. I'm referring to derivatives. Now, if you're not aware of derivatives, I will give you an insight into what they are in lay language and why no one in government was responsible enough to stop them. They could have. Even Bernie Sanders could have. He could have used his enormous popularity among the millennials to explain what a derivative is, why they are toxic time bombs, and why it's not will they collapse the market again, it's how soon and how bad it is because we were misled by everyone in power, including and specifically Obama, in believing that this was not as bad and we had bailed out Wall Street and wasn't that good. No, I said it at the time, we should allow every single employee on Wall Street go to hell. Every one of these people working at Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, because these are economic genocidalists. These are mad people. They are sociopathic. They do not give a damn about you or I or small businesses. But what you hear are specifics. Because are we going to go into another depression? Massive one. Soon? You bet. How soon? Probably within 2 years. Are we in a bubble? We're in 7 bubbles. The last time I warned you, we were in 5. Now we're in 7. Are they going to collapse? They're all going to collapse. It is inevitable. Shouldn't we do something about it? Well, those of us who are aware of it are. And for the others, let's make them aware, and then it's their choice what to do. But I'm going to talk about that today. And for all of you who think it's just a great thing to privatize, well, I'll give you an example of Trump's threatening to privatize our drinking water, and you'll get an idea of how bad that could be. We always begin with the latest on health and healing, because that's something that no matter what our background, our age, our politics, our income, we can make some really healthy changes. Even today, someone who works for me called me and said, hey, I've got an issue. And so I helped them. I gave them a protocol. But then I ask, of all these years you've worked with me, never once have you cared about your health. Now you get the doctor telling you you got a serious condition, and now you're interested. The person says, yep, you're right. You know, I just chose not to do healthy things. It's my choice. So for all the people in America who could know better but choose not to, remember, ignorance is a choice. This is the latest in the University of California. It's about grapes. Now, I believe that grapes are one of nature's 10 most perfect foods, and I believe we should be consuming them. If you can get organic, great. But if you can't, then wash them. And you can get about 95 to 98% of the pesticide residues off by putting it in some. You can use either hydrogen peroxide diluted 20 to 1 with water, then agitate it, then rinse it off. You can use one of these veggie washes where it takes all the surfactant materials off. That's good. However you choose to clean them or buy them, even if you buy them organic, still clean them. Get grapes into your system. From a major study published in Experimental Gerontology, quote, consuming grapes twice a day for 6 months protected against significant metabolic decline in Alzheimer's-related areas of the brain in a study of people with early memory decline. Now, low metabolic activity in these areas of the brain is a hallmark of early-stage Alzheimer's disease, and study results showed a grape-enriched diet protected against the decline of metabolic activity. That's a good thing. And additionally, those consuming a grape-enriched diet also exhibited increased metabolism in other areas of the brain that correlated with individual improvements in attention and working memory performance compared to those not on the diet. Quote from the study. The study examines the impacts of grapes as a whole fruit versus isolated components, and the results suggest that regular intake of grapes may provide a protective effect against early decline associated with Alzheimer's disease, end quote. Let's go back 6 years. It was one of the last studies that I did at my old office, which I had for like a quarter of a century over 92nd and 2nd. Primarily used it for our health support groups and also to do the filming. We built sets, and we would do filming for my PBS specials as well as my lectures. It was a fun place, and lots of good positive energy and insights shared up there. And I had a study group on the brain. Now, you could get into the study group if you suffer from Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, ALS, multiple sclerosis, myasthenia gravis, for at least 5 years, and you were not getting better. That was the criteria. It was medically supervised by a board-certified professor of neurology, but it was not medical. Everything was based upon simply diet changes, exercise, and stress management. At the end of this study, we had some remarkable improvements. Thomas, a 70-year-old African-American engineer, was filmed, and we filmed everyone on their first and last visit. So you could split screen and show before and after. And then they'd tell you what they had the first day they were there and what changed on their last day. And Thomas's hands were just shaking, no control over him. That was on his first day. He also had memory loss. He had muscle loss. He had difficulty with his balance. He couldn't walk very fast because he would fall to one side or the other. And 16 months later, Thomas had no tremors at all, complete memory. In fact, he had acute memory. He could actually recall how many students were in his class in high school, mind you, he's 70, and what their first and last names were. That's acute memory. And then we had a multiple sclerosis patient who completely recovered, 100%, who's alive and well today. And he is a plumber. And we had a woman recover from end-stage Alzheimer's, and a woman from myasthenia gravis, who's alive and well today, doing phenomenally. So the fact that you can help someone, and these are not subjective, this is not anecdotal, because they all had to go through strict medical evaluations, and all their medical records were reviewed. So when you can reverse one of these, and it's never, ever, ever in American history been reversed before, not one. You can slow them down, but you can't reverse them. We reversed it. And then you look back, okay, why didn't that make news? I presented at a scientific conference, 6,000 scientists in Washington, D.C., brought the people down there, actually showed them the results. Not a single inquisitive mind, not inquisitive enough to actually do anything, communicate, come and see what we were doing, try the protocols for themselves, see if it worked for their patients as well. And it taught me something about the idea that, oh yeah, if we can do it, we will, better than what we're doing. No, you won't. The fact is that we had once and for all should start to understand that we will reject everything that does not harmonize with our own values and beliefs, even if what we believe and if what we're doing is not working, is dangerous, killing people, we'll still continue to do it until the people who are in charge, the power policymakers in a belief system, says we must now change. Otherwise, that's why you see so little change in any single movement. And institutions control movements. Hence, you see little change in any institution. And so for those people, and there are quite a number of people, who no longer believe that they should take their values from an institution and the movement of the institution, and they go out on their own, they're finding all new truths. Well, one of the things that I'll be doing today is sharing a commentary about those truths and what we can do to make change if we want. But I started suggesting people drink one large glass, 16 ounces of grape juice a day in that study. Then they were also eating grapes. And one of the people came up and says, why all these grapes? I said, because there's healing nutrients in the grapes that can help your brain. This study just verifies cognitive performance, memory, all enhanced and proven by PET scans from eating grapes. Why? Because the grapes have polyphenols, and that helps promote antioxidant, anti-inflammatory activities. Well, what do you have if you have Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS? You have extreme inflammation of the brain. So by taking an antioxidant is like a fire extinguisher on a fire. That's how you put it out. And there are other things like pomegranates can do it and pomegranate concentration juice. But just drink a glass of grape juice each day. You can get organic grape juice in any supermarket or health food store. Have one glass of that a day. That'll start. And then eat the grapes wherever possible or get grape concentrate. Because those polyphenols and those anti-inflammatory nutrients, they're really good for your brain and improve blood-brain flow. And that helps maintain levels of key brain chemicals to promote memory and exert anti-inflammatory effects. Now, another study from Xinjiang University in China showed, and this was a meta-analysis, meaning they looked at all the different studies that were done on DHA. Now, DHA is one of the fractions that you get when you take the omega-3 fatty acids from fish oil or from vegan sources. And that's why you want to get about 500 milligrams of DHA each day into your system. It shows it had a, quote, substantial evidence that DHA has a favorable effect on liver disease treatment. Now imagine all the liver disease we have in this country. Wow. And we have non-alcoholic liver disease, a fatty liver disease, and that's because of the high fructose corn syrup. Quote, here's what the study said. We believe that the results we have significant implications for the treatment of NAFLD, that's non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And they wrote this in the peer-reviewed journal, Clinical Nutrition. So people have bad livers, alcohol, chemicals from the environment, pesticides, herbicides, plasticizers, and all the things from our microwave cooking and using aluminum, all that junk ends up in your liver. So when you have something that can protect your liver, and you can take it each morning, like your omega-3 fatty acids, that's good. Make sure you're getting your DHA and I would suggest also you take 1 to 2,000 milligrams in the morning and another 1,000 in the afternoon. And if you want to get better arterial health, exercise. From the University of Eastern Finland, quote, higher levels of moderate to vigorous physical activity are associated with lower arterial stiffness. And that's important. This was published in a peer-reviewed journal, Pediatric Exercise Science. And get your kids exercising. Get them out running. Get them playing. Get them into the woods. You know, let them play as children should in nature and with other kids, running and hide-and-go-seek and all the things they could do. Get them on bikes, but stop the carrying of the child and putting them in these, you know, little carriers. That's not healthy for the child. And I see it all the time. We've spoiled our children, and that's not their fault. It's the parents' fault. Let a kid be a kid. It can help their arteries. Alpha-lipoic acid, according to Buck Institute, University of California in San Francisco, is good at preventing kidney stones in this particular model. It was published in Nature Medicine. So, alpha-lipoic, L-I-P-O-I-C, acid, I'm going to suggest between 400 to 600 milligrams a day. It does a lot more in your body, but just the fact that that's a new study, that's important. And also, researchers find that unhealthy gut microbes, that comes from your sugar and your french fries and cakes and candies and alcohol, can cause hypertension. This is published in the Physiological Genomics. Quote, researchers have found that the microorganisms residing in the intestines, the microbiota, play a role in development of high blood pressure. So, good bacteria, and then lower your blood pressure. And finally, from the University of Washington, sweet wormwood, worm, W-O-R-M, wood, W-O-O-D, is 1,000 times more effective than chemotherapy for breast cancer. Now, because we have a lot of women activists listening to this program and a lot of women holistic nurses and physicians listening, this is new information. For every 5 cancer cells that a typical round of chemotherapy affects, one normal cell is destroyed as well. And that's just the beginning when it comes to the dangers of traditional treatments for cancer. But now, University of Washington is reporting about the cancer-killing effects of sweet wormwood, which is a powerful alternative to chemotherapy. Now, there are literally dozens of naturally occurring substances that conventionally trained doctors continue to ignore, which can not only target and destroy cancer cells, but leave healthy cells virtually untouched. And a recent study found that sweet wormwood can kill up to 12,000 cancer cells for every one healthy cell that may be affected. It targets cancer cells through multiple pathways. And first of all, though sweet wormwood is related to the herb that is the main ingredient in one of the liqueurs, the green-colored liqueur that's popular in Europe, it's not the same thing. The active ingredient that makes sweet wormwood, known as sweet Annie, or sweet sagewort, or annual mugwort, or annual wormwood in North America, such a cancer healer is what is known as artemisinin. And Chinese medicine practitioners and others have used it for thousands of years to treat everything from inhibiting parasite growth to immune boosting. So it's also full of cancer-causing terpenes, T-E-R-P-E-N-E-S, such as limonene and B-pinene and the flavonoid quercetin. You've heard me mention quercetin so many times. We need an onion, quercetin, an apple, quercetin. Very important for your skin, keeping your skin wrinkle-free, for helping stopping bruising, little spider veins. Of course, it's terrific for your immune system, and it kills viruses. All of these have something in common. They're all anti-inflammatory, and they're all immune-supporting, and they're all anti-cancer properties. In addition, sweet wormwood contains the flavonoids, lutein and patulin, and also camphor, and myrcene and palmitic acid. Those are all good at promoting enzyme health. So we have something now that can help women with breast cancer, sweet wormwood. And by the way, one other thing from Australia Research Center, fiber supplements cut your cholesterol, your blood glucose sugar, and this was a 12-month study, and it made a big difference. So get your fiber. I'm suggesting 40 to 50 grams a day, and that can make all the difference. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Noll. A lot of you, in fact, about 98% of you, don't listen live each day, Monday to Friday, noon to 1. You listen at night when you get home. And we can listen right over the radio, over the internet, but also you can listen anywhere you're at in the world but over the internet. But you can listen by telephone as well. Let me give you the archive telephone number. Write this down, please. 701-719-9976. So if you miss a show, you can go back and listen to any of the last five shows, 701-719-9976. Now, I'm concerned with Donald Trump's behavior, but I saw it coming. I saw that, in my personal opinion, he is not capable of understanding deep issues. He wants headlines only. He's fairly feeble-minded that way. Not that it's genetic. It is not. It's just behavioral. He doesn't want to take the time to study. He doesn't have the patience. Generally, people with such a narcissistic complex don't have patience. They react. They don't reason. They don't want to become more scholarly. For that, you have to read lots of homework, lots of research. And he doesn't do that. Hence, he surrounds himself with people who give him their opinion. They give him short, synoptic insights. And then he reacts from there, as if he knows what he's talking about. He actually speaks at a sixth grade level. That is the right beside George Bush. The two of them are about the same when it comes to intellectual expression. But if a person cannot express themselves articulately, that does not necessarily negate that they might understand it, just not be good at expressing. Well, Trump's is not a person that has difficulty expressing himself. He just doesn't have, in my opinion, the depth of understanding of any issue, nor the sensitivity of that issue, nor the context to deconstruct an issue, an argument. So therefore, what is happening is we're beginning to look at the media and how they're treating Trump and how Trump is treating the people and the media. And it's like watching a bunch of scorpions in a cocktail glass fight. I want to share some insights about what many consider these dark times, especially Professor Henry Giroux, because I believe they are, on one hand, dark. On the other hand, it's finally becoming a positive. Why is it a positive? I'll share my positive position first. Because had Hillary Clinton been elected, you'd had no demonstrations, you'd had no marches, and yet the killing in Yemen would have increased, the killing in Syria would have increased, you would have had a no-fly zone, you would have had Israel unleashing all of its armed might upon Iran, which would have caused a whole new world war in the Middle East, which would have adversely affected us. You would have had more countries with more PSYOPs, you would have had more demonstrators targeted. And the irony of it is the very people who would have voted for her would have been the very people who would now be on enemies' lists and targeted for complete detention. You would have had the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TTRP partnership gone through. You would have had the shackles off Wall Street. You would have had privatization of everything. And yet, because of an ideological alignment, like a frog boiling in water, it wouldn't have realized it was boiling to death because of its alignment. So at least we get to see how corrupt the entire institution of government is at every level. Of all the bureaucracies are corrupt, of all the legislative branches are corrupt, the executive branch is corrupt. They're all corrupt. They're all a bunch of imbeciles, in my opinion. I mean, if we put Daffy Duck as president of the United States, we would have equally competent president. It doesn't matter because the people that really control everything, the deep state, they're the ones laughing at all this. So that's why I say we have dark times, but we also have light times because we're seeing how bad it is with Trump. So the dark times that haunt the current age no longer appear as merely an impending threat. They have materialized with the election of Donald Trump to the presidency. And Trump and his administration of extremists, and they're all extremists, they epitomize the dire dangers posed by those who longed to rule America's society without resistance and dominate its major political parties and secure uncontested control of its commanding political and cultural and economic institutions. How can I put this? The consolidation of power and wealth in the hands of the financial elite, along with the savagery and misery that signifies their policies, is no longer the stuff of Hollywood films such as Wall Street or American Psycho. If George W. Bush's reign of fear-mongering and greed and war on terror embodied the values of a kind of militarized Gordon Gekko, Trump represents the metamorphosis of Gekko into the deranged and ethnically neutered Patrick Bateman. And yet, Trump's ascent to the highest office in America is already being normalized by numerous pundits and politicians. As might be expected, a range of supine politicians and media pundits and mainstream journalists are already tying themselves to what Tom Engelhardt calls apologetic knots, while they desperately look for signs that Donald Trump will be a pragmatic, recognizable American president once he takes the mantle of power. It's not going to happen. Trump is not ordinary, and his politics forebode the storm clouds of an American version of authoritarianism. The whole point to bring home is this is not normal, and of course, it shouldn't be. We don't need any more normal. We've just gone through 32 years of normal. We were normal under Reagan, normal under Bush, normal under Clinton, normal under Obama. And look how normal worked. As long as a person made a good presentation, wore the right clothes, spoke in a certain cadence, with a certain tone and intuition, we accepted them. We didn't look any further. If they told us they were about peace, we didn't look at the war they were bringing to other countries. If they said they wanted to protect the interests of democracy, we didn't look at how they were decimating, like in Honduras, a democratically elected president because we didn't like their policies concerning American privatization. So we didn't choose to be put into a discomfort by finding the truth behind the illusion. So we need something that is a groundswell of protest that is not normal. Because when was the last time we had the average American protesting? Let's say at Indian Point. We had about 2,500. 8,000 of my audience marched down to Washington, D.C. for 10 days to protest genetic engineering. That's 8,000 out of 330 million. An insignificant amount. Significant for what it was, because an empowered minority can still empower change. Where were all the people protesting against Monsanto? They weren't there. They were using their products. And jobs being offshored, they were going into Walmart and other stores and buying the very products that had once been made with union labor in the United States. So the hypocrisy was palpable. So we need something different. What we don't need is we don't need a Stephen Bannon. And we don't need a Jeff Sessions. two men with racism in their past. These were just ordinary appointments. High-profile celebrity Oprah Winfrey stated without irony in an interview with Entertainment Tonight that, quote, I just saw President-elect Trump and President Obama in the White House, and it gave me hope. Really? Well, that's quite a stretch, given Trump's history of racist practices, his racist remarks about black people and Muslims and Mexican immigrants during the primary and the presidential campaigns, and his appointment of a number of cabinet members who embrace a white nationalist ideology. So where is the change going to come from that? The mainstream media and such highly visible pundits point to not just a retreat from responsible reporting and discourse and a fight from any vestige of social responsibility, but also the further collapse of serious journalism and thoughtful reasoning into the corrupt world of a corporate-controlled media empire and the infant mindset of a celebrity culture. Normalizing the Trump regime does more than sabotage the truth and moral responsibility and justice. It also cancels out the democratic institutions necessary for a future of well-being and economic and political justice. So any talk of working with a president who has surrounded himself with militarists, racists, neo-fascists, anti-intellectuals, and neoliberal fundamentalists should be resisted at all cost. It is worth remembering that Trump chose Steve Bannon, a notorious anti-Semite and white supremacist, to the center of power in the White House. As Reuters reported, white supremacist neo-Nazis have rarely, if ever, in recent history been so enthusiastic about a presidential appointment as Donald Trump's choice of Steve Bannon to his chief White House strategist. And what that means is that since we have a functionally illiterate man in the White House, he will surround himself with people who are not illiterate, but are ideologues, nationalists, which is a danger. Because then what you really have is you have Steve Bannon as the President of the United States, because he is the one who is first in the morning and last at night telling the Donald what to believe in. And Donald still believes this is a reality television show. It isn't. But let's go a little further. I want you to hear a clip now. This is from the David Pakman show. I'll play you just a little bit of it to give you something to think about.
I can't believe I even have to do this, but it's increasingly unclear to me that Donald Trump can comfortably read the written English language. I mean, like English written on pages. I genuinely think, after reviewing a bunch of videos and comments and evidence yesterday, that Donald Trump may barely be able to read. Let's start with some journalists who have interviewed Donald Trump, who have come to the conclusion that certainly Donald Trump doesn't read. We'll start there.
There was one point when I asked him how he was preparing to possibly be president, and are you reading the great presidential biographies, for example? And he paused for an unusually long time. His voice became almost tender, and he said, you know, I've never read a biography, but I've always wanted to.
You ask him as he's leaving the interview and going to bed, what are you reading? What was that? And what did he say?
He kind of had that look. Oh, yeah, you got me. And then he tried to answer, and he said he's reading this book that Ed Klein wrote, A Hatchet Job on Hillary Clinton, of course, which I'm sure he's not reading. Then there was a book about Nixon, which he couldn't remember exactly.
Right. So Trump has said many times on the campaign trail that one of the main reasons he'd be a good president was because of the stuff that he wrote about his life in Art of the Deal, but of course we know he didn't actually write it. And one of the most notable things to come from an interview with the guy who actually wrote Art of the Deal, Tony Schwartz, is that he realized that not only did Trump have essentially no attention span whatsoever, which connects to his concerning level of TV watching that we've heard about over the last week or so, but also that he would be shocked to learn that Trump had read a single book cover to cover in his entire adult life. Again, this is a quote from an interview with Tony Schwartz, where he said, that's why he so prefers TV as his first news source. Information comes in easily digestible sound bites. I seriously doubt that Trump has ever read a book straight through in his adult life. He also said that during the entire 18 months that he was writing the book with Trump and observing Trump, he never once even saw a book on Donald Trump's desk or anywhere in his office or in his apartment. So Fine, Donald Trump doesn't read, but can he read is really the question. Let's now put this together with that report from last week from Axios.com about the total disarray that the Trump administration is in. And one of the main disturbing aspects of the early days of the Trump administration, according to insiders at the Trump White House, is that Donald Trump seems fixated on watching TV and cannot focus on nor read any of the reports or briefings or white papers or anything. His advisors have even said he doesn't even really surf the web or use a computer. He'll scroll through Twitter on his phone and dictate tweets to people in the other room. That's yet another layer to this thing, that Donald Trump may not only have trouble reading, but also have trouble writing. As we've talked about before, and Trump has even tweeted about this himself, I dictate my tweets to my executive assistant and she posts them. Quote, time is money, source, The Art of the Deal. Of course, the phrase time is money didn't even come from The Art of the Deal. And again, this further continues to call into question both Donald Trump's reading and writing skills. His advisors have now also said Trump avoids reading any report or briefing that he finds to be too lengthy, and he will often just glance at the first page without even making it evident whether he understands what's on the page. It continues. Listen to this strange conversation that Mark Fisher had with Donald Trump.
So I pressed a little harder and I said, well, how are you preparing? How will you make decisions as president? And he said, well, I'm not going to be reading any big reports or anything like that. And he told me the story of how a guy from Wall Street came to him, wanted him to make a deal in China, and said there was an innovative kind of financing that he wanted Trump to consider. And so Trump said, well, I don't know anything about that. And the guy said, no problem. We've done some research. I have a report. I'll send it to you today. And Trump said, don't send me any blanking reports, and said, because I won't read them.
And here is Trump telling Chuck Todd that he gets his foreign policy advice from TV. Odd place for a presidential candidate to be getting foreign policy advice.
Who do you talk to for military advice right now?
Well, I watch the shows. I mean, I really see a lot of great, you know, when you watch your show and all of the other shows and you have the generals and you have certain people.
So that's circumstantial. Trump doesn't read. But is he avoiding reading because he doesn't like it or because he has trouble reading? And here is where it all explodes. I recently saw this interview I'm about to play for you on the Opie with Jim Norton radio show with Saturday Night Live's Pete Davidson. And Pete Davidson described that when Trump was guest hosting Saturday Night Live, he genuinely seemed unable to read the script. Let's take a look at this.
Okay, so he's like, he doesn't really know how to read.
For real.
Yeah. So during, like, the table read, he, like, before, like, we were going to read each, before he had to read each line, and he's the host, so he's at everything.
Yeah.
He would go, I'm not going to say this. I think I'm going to say it the way I want to say it. Is that okay? Is that okay, Lauren? Is that everything? And everybody's like, what? And then this is my favorite part, is there was a sketch that we wrote where he's at Disneyland with his daughter, and the line is, all right, let's get out of here. Turkey legs? Like, let's, like, go get turkey legs? And he doesn't know how to read. So he went, all right, let's get out of here, turkey legs. He called his daughter turkey legs. And then he looked up, like, he doesn't get it. Like, he thinks if everybody's laughing with him, but we're all laughing at him.
So this would explain why it's such a disaster every time Trump tries to use a teleprompter. Not because he's unfamiliar with prompters, but because he's not a very good reader. Let's take a look at just one of these awkward teleprompter debacles.
Everything that is broken today can be fixed, and every failure can be turned into a truly great success. Just look at the way I just melded into the teleprompter.
Yeah. So now here's where it gets completely nuts. I took a look at some specific portions of a deposition that Trump gave in June of last year. And there are some really, really clear attempts here to avoid having to read out loud. His lawyer clearly doesn't want Trump to do any reading out loud. And here is the first clip where Trump says, I don't read leases. Let's start with that.
Did you review the lease at all before you signed it?
No.
How many leases like this have you reviewed in your career?
Signed or reviewed?
Reviewed.
Not too many. I signed 100.
Right. So he's never really reviewed a lease, and then he's asked to read a portion, and his lawyer really doesn't like it.
Yeah.
You did not review this section
what
of the lease.
What does that say?
Monetary damages. This is the in the remedies section.
I did not, no.
Okay. Would you be able to read this section and tell us what your understanding of it is?
Objection. Mr. Trump isn't a lawyer.
I mean, do you want me to read it? It's long.
It is long.
Understand what this is about. This is not to mock or denigrate him for not being able to read. Most Americans, even with a college education, do not always understand the context or the larger meaning of what they read. This is the most powerful man in the world. On the one hand, if I were to suggest to a Donald Trump that he is supporting a militarization of the world and we should be having ambassadors in every country who are not political hacks, who got to be an ambassador because of how much money they bundled or gave to an electorate, but instead real diplomats, people who are going there who have a track record of bringing people together, apologizing for past mistakes, trying to make reparations and helping countries get out of there, stop bombing, stop droning, start helping them to rebuild. And I would say, but everyone you surrounded yourself with, every single person, is a militarist, interested in looking at the project as kill the enemy, conquer their lands, control their government. And we have 900 of these bases around the country, around the world. But we don't have 900 ambassadors, but we have 900 military bases. He wouldn't understand that. He wants something explained very simply. Oh, who are the enemy? Who should we boycott from coming into America? Well, these seven countries. If he read and if he cared about the issue, then he would study each of those countries and say, all right, what threat have they posed, either real or existential, in the past 50 years to the United States? Which of these seven countries have caused terrorist attacks in the United States? How about none? Not one. How many countries has Iran invaded since they're at the top of the list? None. They've supplied help to other countries, but you have to look at the context in which we are approaching. You never hear any of the rabid, you know, red-eyed people at Fox and other places when they're talking about Iran. You never hear them talk about how we, the United States, undermined and destroyed through a coup Mossadegh in 1953, who was a democratically elected and a progressive politician. He simply wanted better royalty arrangements with British Petroleum, who had a monopoly, and it wasn't fair to the country. So we installed the Shah of Iran. No one ever says how many people died or were imprisoned under the Shah of Iran. So when they finally threw off the yoke of 25 years of being brutalized, imprisoned, tortured, and their oil exploited by the United States and other countries, that will at least give you a context of why we shouldn't be approaching them as if they're the enemy. They have never been our enemy. They have been angry. They have revolted. But we're the ones who got a million dead Iranians in a war that we supported Iraq against Iran. Iraq would never have invaded Iran without us. We don't talk about this. If a man does not have the intellectual capacity to understand the nuance of every one of these issues, then he is going to fumble through everything he does. Even if he doesn't want to, he will. And unless you have worked with people who are so feeble-minded, who lack complete awareness of the world they live in, who have no real sense of anything except the deals they do, and why didn't you put Saudi Arabia, the number one terrorist country in the world, on that, and Turkey number two, and Kuwait number three, and Qatar number four, and United Arab Emirates number five? Why aren't those five on there? Because they're the ones that actually have exported terrorism, were involved in American terrorist attacks, including 9/11. He won't understand that. He regresses back into an ego-laden a minefield where he must react. He must attack you, denigrate you, imposture. This is the type of person we want? I think not. So what do we do about it? Well, I've suggested that we start some women's movements immediately to protest in front of all of the embassies that are shown to give no rights to women in their countries, to boycott their products, and to be physically there and boycotting and demonstrating peacefully in front of their embassies, like Saudi Arabia and Turkey. That would get some attention, and then give out information, documentaries, and stories about how badly women are treated in their countries. So I believe that would help us, because he just doesn't seem to understand this at all. But there are a lot of other things we can do, and easy things, things that are not that difficult. It just takes organization. For example, we should start reforming the prison system. We should have a major movement with articles. We have plenty, and people within the system, we have many, to talk about reforming women's prison systems and the treatment of women in prison, and then from there to men, and then juvenile detention. Let's clean up the whole system, because about 50% of all the people in jail should not be in jail. And let's stop genital mutilation around the world. And let's protest every single country that has a record of female violence. The Gulf states, Pakistan, Egypt, and now, never under Libya with Gaddafi, but now Libya, yes, because it's under terrorists. Let us look at protesting, for example, banks who foreclose on women homeowners. Make that a whole women's issue. Because if you got the women of America protesting when a woman loses her home, and because she was given a completely fraudulent mortgage, and the bankers are making profit from her failure, that should be an element of protest. We could have local food projects to relieve the 70 million women and children in the United States on the brink of poverty. We could have, join an anti-GMO effort that's now fully functional by going towards the Organic Consumers Organization or Food and Water Watch. We could join the anti-vaccination organizations like INVIC, NVIC. And tomorrow I'm going to be doing a special in-depth original investigative report exclusively on our program at noon tomorrow about the studies that show there are connections direct between vaccine and autism. That'll be tomorrow, and then I'll post it. We could have local and state organizations, now that the Environmental Protection Agency is being politicized, we could go after coal, fracking, pipeline, and nuclear plants. And so there's a lot that we can do that would not disrupt our lives, but would make a difference. And finally, let us understand that we can interfere nonviolently in the governing structure of our society. If we do not protest, if we simply go along with it, then we're doing what we've done for the last 32 years, which has allowed those in power and those people behind those people in power, who are the real power, to continue to create a massive inequality. I support what Chris Hedges has suggested, and that's that Donald Trump's regime is rapidly reconfiguring the United States into an authoritarian state. What's that mean? It means that all forms of dissent will soon be criminalized. That means that civil liberties will no longer exist as we have known them historically. What we have, we will have corporate exploitation through the abolition of regulations and laws, and those will be unimpeded, just as global warming, that I've been doing a lot of programs on, will accelerate. A repugnant nationalism amplified by government propaganda will promote bigotry and racism, and hate crimes will explode. New wars will be launched and expanded. And as this happens, those Americans who remain passive will be complicit. Flurries of executive orders, memorandums are being issued to demolish the anemic remnants of our bankrupt democracy, and those being placed in power, such as Betty DeVos, who, if confirmed as Secretary of Education, will defund our system of public education and expand schools run by the Christian right, and Scott Pruitt, who, if confirmed as head of the Environmental Protection Agency, will dismantle it. These are agents of destruction. In the eyes of the Christian fascists and the generals and the billionaires and the conspiracy promoters around Trump, the laws, the courts, and the legislative bodies exist only to silence opponents and swell corporate profits. Stephen Bannon, who I mentioned earlier in the program, is the president's chief counselor, and he was behind the ban on Muslims entering the United States from seven Muslim-majority countries, a ban you can expect to see extended if the Trump administration is successful in removing a stay issued by a district court. He was behind the order to the Department of Homeland Security to drop lists of Muslim organizations and individuals in the United States that, in the language of the executive action, have been radicalized and have provided some material support. Well, such lists will be used to criminalize Muslim leaders and the institutions and organizations they built. And then once the Muslims are dealt with domestically, how long do you think it'll be before Homeland Security will have lists that will allow the government to target the press, all activists, labor leaders, all dissenting intellectuals, and everyone on the left that dissents? It is the beginning of a fascist version of Leon Trotsky's permanent revolution. Leon Trotsky had one vision. Lenin had another. Lenin wanted to destroy the state. And according to Bannon, that's his goal as well. The Trump regime's demented project of social engineering, which will come wrapped in a Christianized fascism, can be implemented only if it quickly seizes control of the bureaucratic mechanisms of government. If nonviolent protest is met with violence, we must never respond with violence. The use of violence, including property destruction and taunting the police, those are just gifts to the security and surveillance state. It allows the state to demonize and isolate the mass movement. It drives away the bulk of the population. Violence against the state is used by the authorities to justify greater forms of control and repression. The corporate state understands and welcomes the language of force. This is the game the government always wins, and we always lose. If we are perceived as a flag-burning, rock-throwing, angry mob that embraces violence, watch how quickly we are crushed, and watch how quickly the American people as a whole turn away because they say, that is not what I represent. No different than the attacks against the speaker in Berkeley. If you want to disagree with someone, debate them. Write articles about them. Offer yourself there as a counterpoint. But that kind of mad rampage did not serve the First Amendment advocates well. That's a new form of McCarthyism. And McCarthyism is just as bad on the left as it is on the right. I may disagree with you and your positions, but I have no right to keep you from speaking them or others from hearing you. And this is just madness and irresponsible, in my opinion. But for those of us who've been around a while and have been involved in social issues, protest, yes, but at least within a civil decorum that allows the person we're opposing to have their time also. Otherwise, what happens when they demonstrate against us? From our going into colleges to give speeches to the people who want to hear our message or anywhere else. We can succeed only if we win the hearts and minds of the wider public and ultimately many of those within the structures of power, including the police. When violence is used against nonviolent protesters demanding basic forms of justice, it exposes the weakness of the state, the government, and those in power. It delegitimizes those in power. It prompts a passive population to respond with active support for the protesters. It creates internal divisions within the structures of power. And the Trump regime is populated with blind fanatics. They believe in one truth, which is whatever they proclaim at the moment, any such declaration may contradict what they have said a few hours before. That's irrelevant to them. They're possessed with one idea, and that is everything is a conflict. They venerate a demented hypermasculinity that includes us, the use of violence, misogyny, a disdain for empathy, the self-appointing right to engage in bouts of frenzied rage. These characteristics, they believe, are a sign of masculinity. The highest aesthetic is militarism, violence, and war. So without conflict, without enemies, real or imagined, their ideological structures and racist ideas collapse into a heap of contradictions and absurdities. They will attempt to thwart nonviolent nationwide resistance with force, and they will attempt to stoke counterviolence, including through the use of agent provocateurs. Do you not think that every major demonstration, every single group in America that protests anything is not filled with agent provocateurs? My goodness, look at what the FBI has stated on the record. They have used every single opportunity to put their agents into every single movement there is, no matter how peaceful. They want their agents in. The alt-right, self-declared intellectuals, ferret out facts and formulas that buttress their particular worldview and discard truths that contradict their messianic delusions. They mouth a few cliches and quote a few philosophers to justify bigotry and chauvinism and governmental repression. It is propaganda masquerading as ideology. These pseudo-intellectuals are singularly incurious. They are linguistically, culturally, and historically illiterate about the Muslim world and about most other foreign cultures, yet blithely write off one-fifth of the world's population of Muslims as irredeemable. In conclusion, the inability of white supremacists like Trump and Banyan to recognize the humanity of others springs from their spiritual impoverishment. They mistake bigotry for honesty and ignorance for innocence. They cannot separate fantasy from reality. Such people are, well, it was James Baldwin who called them moral monsters. Evil for them is embodied in the dehumanization of others. Once the human personification of evil is eradicated, evil itself is supposed to disappear, except, of course, that as soon as one group of human beings is annihilated, another human embodiment of evil rises to take its place. The Nazis began with the Jews. Our fanatics are beginning with Muslims. History has shown where they will all go from there. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.